Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello there, Buzzkillers. It's your favorite professor here. And of course, we're back again with Professor John Giebfried from St. Louis University. Professor, welcome back to the bunker.
I'm glad to be back. We had some unfinished business to do in the Mongol Empire.
We certainly did. Last time you were talking about Genghis Khan and you mentioned Marco Polo, and I asked if you'd come back to talk about that.
Very happy to. He's a
very
popular guy.
Yeah,
he's got a TV show now. It's
On Netflix, right?
Yeah. Not exactly the most historically accurate thing in the world, but...
How did that happen?
They didn't hire us.
They should have hired us. And of course, we charge a lot. So, you know, we have to...
That's true.
They don't want to pay me. Well, Netflix aside, who was the real Marco Polo?
Well, Marco Polo is a Venetian merchant. He leaves Europe in 1271 at age 17. He travels all around the Mongol Empire in the time of Genghis Khan's grandson, Kublai Khan. Comes back to Europe in 1295, age 41. He then goes on and lives a boring second half of his life, comparatively at least to the first. He marries, has a couple daughters, and then dies of old age at 69 or 70 in 1324.
Well, almost everybody, when they think of Marco Polo, they think about all these trips and travels. Why did he go?
Well, he went with his father, Niccolo, and his uncle, Maffeo, who accidentally had ended up there earlier. They were coming back. So on their second trip, they brought young Marco along.
Oh, okay. How did they do that?
So Niccolo and Maffeo were Venetian merchants.
Right.
On our previous show, we talked about how Mongol taxes were a lot lower, and so people were trying to trade with them.
Yeah.
And the Polos are some of these merchants. They were trading in Constantinople, which at this point was occupied by the Crusaders, who took it from the Greeks in 1204. And in 1260, hearing about sort of the money you could make dealing with the Mongols, they left Constantinople to trade in Crimea, which was under Mongol rule. And while they were over there, they heard that Constantinople had fallen to the Greeks, so they couldn't exactly go back the way they came. So they decided, let's go the long way around through sort of Central Asia, through the Middle East, and sort of cut back that way. And as they're doing that, they got roped into joining an embassy to the great Khan Kublai, who was interested about Europe and Christianity. And so they end up meeting Kublai Khan, who sends the two of them back to the Pope. And Kublai has a shopping list. He says, I want these books. I want this stuff. I want 100 religious experts to come and talk to me about Christianity. And while I'm at it, I'd like some oil from the lamp of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem.
That's a lot to ask for.
Yeah. So what happens is that on their way back, they stop in Venice. They pick up 17-year-old Marco a decade after he first left. So dad was supposed to be away for a short training, a short trading mission at age 7. He comes back 10 years later. No one knows if he's alive or dead. And then he's like, oh, I went to the Great Khan and I have to go talk to the Pope now too. And he says, Marco's like, can I come along? And so he comes along. They end up getting the oil. They couldn't get the Pope to spare 100 missionaries. So in the end, they only have 2. And the 2 missionaries both chicken out on the way there. And so it really is, we're supposed to come with 100 guys. Sorry, all we brought is ourselves and some oil. So what happens is, we have to rely on Marco's own account, which may be exaggerated. But after this point, the Polos, and especially Marco, enter Kublai Khan's service. Marco becomes one of the Khan's favorites, goes on missions for him across the empire for the next 2 decades. He finally gets to go home doing one last mission. And For all the fans of the Netflix Marco Polo series, skip ahead about a minute. because he escorts a royal princess to go marry one of Kublai's relatives, his brother's grandson, essentially, who's ruling the Mongol Empire in the Middle East at this point.
So there's a spoiler alert we're trying to warn people about there.
Yeah. You know, I have my own theory about what will happen in the show, but I don't want to say what happens there. Anyway, the person she's supposed to marry ends up dying. So she marries that guy's son. And then Marco, his work done, goes back to Italy. And his story might have been lost, except for the first thing he does once he gets back is he signs up to fight in one of Venice's long ongoing wars with their arch rival Genoa.
Yeah.
He equips his own ship with part of the money that he came back with, because he came back with literally diamonds sort of stuffed on the inside of his pockets, that he had lots and lots of cash. He ends up losing in battle and being locked in prison. But we as historians should be lucky that he was locked in prison, because his cellmate was a guy named Rusticello of Pisa, a writer of Arthurian romances.
Arthurian, wow.
And so he had been writing about like Arthur and Guinevere and Lancelot and all that. But now he's locked up and he's hearing all these stories about China from his cellmate Marco. And he says, hey, you know what? This would make a really good book. I can write it for you. And that's what he does. And the book gets published as soon as the two of them are set free.
Wow. Okay. So what are the major myths then about Marco Polo, especially the ones the Buzzkillers would know?
All right. So there's a handful of misconceptions about him and his voyage. And then there's a couple of long-standing myths, the king of which is that he brought back pasta to Italy. And its cousin that he brought back ice cream to Italy. And then finally, we have the big historical myth that's sort of developing in its own right. The question and sort of the debate, did Marco Polo actually go to China, or is he just making it all up?
Well, let's start with the misconceptions. Those are probably the best place to begin.
All right. Well, the first thing is that the travels of Marco Polo are not written by Marco Polo. Marco is literate and he's a good storyteller, but it's the Arthurian author Rusticello who really makes it a bestseller. And Rusticello has to sort of tone down Marco from time to time. My favorite example of this is he goes around jazzing up and skipping parts when Marco is just going on and on and on. So
into
Marco is
detail.
Talking about his trip in China, and he goes through the details of three different sort of kingdoms in southern China he visits. And then Rusticello comes in and says, we could tell you about the other six, but since there would be a long business to go over, we will keep silent about them. And that's the sort of a nice quote from the text.
That sounds like he might have been a Hollywood script editor.
Yeah.
In the earlier age.
Mm-hmm. And the other myth is that Marco Polo is the first person to go to China from Europe, which is not true. We know all the way back to the Roman Empire that there were emissaries from ancient Rome that went to China. And with the rise of the Mongols, there are many travelers who go from Europe to the Mongol court on diplomatic business and such. And of course, two people who beat him there are his father and uncle, who are the reason he went in the first place.
But is the reason we think of it as Marco is because he was the first one to write about the journey, his journey anyway?
No, in terms of the first European to sort of write stuff down, that goes to a Franciscan monk named John of Plano Carpini, who went in the 1240s. So he's got about a three-decade head start on Marco. And he is sort of on a diplomatic/intelligence-gathering mission for the Pope.
Yeah.
And a decade later, you have another Franciscan named William of Rubric who makes a similar journey. That I have a couple friends who are Dominican priests, and sometimes I like to poke fun at them, that both the Franciscans who set off to go to China actually made it there, whereas the two missionaries and sort of religious experts that were supposed to go with the Polos were both Dominicans, and they both chickened out along the way. So,
well, what you've done is you've shown us that, you know, it, like all these other things we address, it's much more complicated than, you know, the popular version, the popular misconception. What about the big myths about the pasta and the ice cream? I'm sure Buzzkillers want to hear about this.
All right. So of the two myths, that the pasta one gets repeated more often, but no less an authority than the International Dairy Foods Association on their website still lists the myth that Marco Polo brought back ice cream from China. What we know about this is that the Chinese had frozen milk drinks dating back to the Tang Dynasty in the early Middle Ages. But our ice cream has different origins from that. It actually comes from sherbet, which earlier on is sort of fruit flavored with ice. And this was invented by sort of the Muslims of the Middle East, and the Italians took it from them. Eventually, sort of sherbet was turned into ice cream by adding milk, but this was done centuries after Marco died. Also, it should be pointed out that Marco never mentions ice cream in his account.
Oh.
This Marco Polo invented ice cream, or he brought it back from China, was created by your favorite category of myth makers, people living in the 19th century popularizing, just coming up with things. It's those 19th century people strike again.
They do that a lot, especially when they want to, you know, show heroic voyagers bringing back things and discovering things.
Yes, definitely. The hero for ice cream lovers out there is actually an Italian chef by the name of Antonio Latini, who lived from 1642 to 1692. He was a chef working at the royal court in Naples. And we don't know if he invented it, but he's the first one to write down a cookbook with a recipe for a milk-based sorbet in it, which most culinary historians credit as the first official ice cream recipe that we have. And his cookbook is also famous for another invention that it comes up with. It's the first use of a tomato-based sauce. So it's the first tomato sauce, also comes from his cookbook.
Oh, well, that's tomato sauce. That's a good segue into the pasta myth.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I should point out that Antonio Latini did not suggest that you use tomato sauce on pasta. That wasn't what he added it with. But when we get to pasta, this is another case. Pasta exists in Italy, in this case, long before Marco Polo. We have an Arab geographer who's traveling around Sicily in 1154, and he talks about how the people of Sicily made this pasta from flour that was formed into long strings. So spaghetti in the 1100s, a full more than a century before Marco Polo.
Oh, sure.
In fact, what Marco Polo does talk about pasta in his memoirs, and he says that the people in this area ate macaroni or other sorts of pasta. In one translation, gives it as lasagna instead of macaroni, but that's sort of a question one there. But he does so casually, as if he knows his readers already are familiar with pasta, so he doesn't have to explain, oh, it's all these nice long strings of things, and doesn't explain what pasta is.
He's assuming they already eat pasta at home, so they'll understand what he's saying about Chinese pasta, in effect.
Yeah, essentially essentially that's it.
Well, the bigger myth, really, I mean, these pasta and ice cream things are fascinating, and it talk a lot, and it explains a lot about these 19th century inventions, but what about the myth that where people effectively doubt that Marco Polo actually went to China?
So this argument has been around, but it was greatly popularized by the book Did Marco Polo Go to China? By Dr. Francis Wood, which was published back in 1996. Now, Francis Wood is not a nobody. She was the curator of the Chinese collections of the British Library. Yeah. So when she stood up and said, I don't think Marco Polo went to China, people listened, and it brought out sort of a big debate. And she, in her book, goes through a long list of things that Marco Polo went to China, but he never mentions so many typical Chinese things. For example, he doesn't mention the Great Wall. He doesn't mention Confucianism, foot binding, chopsticks, printing, tea. How do you go to China and not talk about tea?
Yeah, those seem to be a lot of omissions.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Marco's story is peppered with all these other myths from his own time. And it's filled with things that if he actually went there or he knew about it, that it would seem absolutely fabulous. So my one of my favorites is about Japan. And he talks about in Japan, they have these sort of super unkillable warriors and that they have these magic stones that they embed underneath the skin of their arms that makes them invulnerable to steel. So these Japanese warriors, when Kublai Khan tried to chop off their heads, it didn't work. So instead, they had to beat them to death with clubs. And then they took the magic stones, which were, to quote Marco Polo, taken off to India, where they were in much demand. I don't know why you wouldn't keep these stones that make you invulnerable to having your head chopped off. Yeah. But apparently they sold them off. He also talks about in Japan about how there's a palace where the roof is made of gold, where the chambers are paved with gold over two fingers thick, and the halls and windows are sort of all sort of covered in gold. So, and I think this should be obvious to say, there's no palace in Japan whereby you have just a palace made of pretty much solid gold. He also talks about a bird that lives in Madagascar called a rook, which is so big and so strong, it picks up elephants and smashes them against rocks. So, and then when they splatter, it goes apart and eats elephants. So I can just imagine how scary one of those birds will be.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah. My favorite story, however, has to do about how you get diamonds in India. He tells a story in the Indian kingdom of Mudfili that there is a gigantic valley there, which is filled with diamonds, that just the whole valley is littered with diamonds. However, the valley is also loaded with venomous serpents. So if you go down to try to grab them, you'll be attacked and killed by snakes. So what do you do to get out the diamonds? What you do is the men toss down meat into the valley, and then they get eagles, giant white eagles, to fly down and pick up the meat. And while the eagles are eating the meat, you pick up all the diamonds that got stuck to the meat when you tossed it down. And that's how you get diamonds and where diamonds come from and why diamonds are so expensive. So looking at this evidence, Wood's conclusion is that Marco never went to China. He's merely just compiling together various crazy travel stories he's heard of.
Yeah, it sounds like he's just retailing myths, and they're at least one remove from the actual experience.
And it wouldn't be the case where Marco Polo is the only fake medieval traveler. You have the case of the English explorer, John Mandeville.
Explorer, you're putting in quotes, I can hear.
Yes, putting quotes around that. That John Mandeville was actually a fake person. So there wasn't even a John Mandeville. Someone just made up him as a title and talked about travel stories and said that, oh, I, John Mandeville, went all the way to China and everywhere and did all this. And historians pretty easily figured out that John Mandeville maybe made it to Constantinople at the furthest. Then everything else is just a forgery and a cobbling together of myths and different stories. However, John Mandeville's story in his time actually outsold Marco Polo. There's sort of some argument there.
Well, Wood's argument sounds very interesting. What do other historians, other critics say? Why doesn't Marco Polo talk about these very Chinese things?
Well, Wood eventually, the argument has gone on, and she managed to win over only a small number of historians to her camp. But what she did was sort of get historians to interface with these problems in his account.
Uh-huh.
Nowadays, most follow the line that I think Timothy May in his book sort of clearly summarizes, namely that Marco Polo is really immersed in a Mongol viewpoint and in sort of a Mongol world, that he is not looking at China through Chinese eyes, that he is a functionary of the Mongol court. And so what's interesting to the Mongols and what they think about and what they do, he does record. And there are things that may seem obvious about China today, but to him, it didn't stick out to him, or it didn't stick out to Rustichello. It's like, who wants to hear about this tea thing? Not particularly interesting. Meanwhile, there is a lot of evidence from his text that he did go to China. Not only does he know the names of cities and their relative location, which he could have learned about from a written source, but he knew things in sort of such details that it would be impossible for someone to go to fake going to China and still write about. So this is more boring stuff that appeals to a merchant, Venetian like Marco Polo, talking about their currency system and how currency works, that he goes on for a long time about the paper money system with details that only like an official in that system would know. He goes on forever about salt production details, which no one's just making up, especially when it turns out they're true.
Yeah.
And also tax revenues. One scholar by the name of Hans-Ulrich Vogel even went through Chinese tax records to see if they matched up with how much the estimates that Marco said, like, oh, they collect this amount of money from this city. And Vogel's work basically said, yeah, that's about how much they were paying in taxes. So that's sort of pretty definitive proof that he was there because no one's sort of smuggling back tax records. Right. To figure these things out.
And if you follow the money, as they say, you often find the actual truth.
Yeah, definitely. And moreover, the myths that he's reporting, the stories about the unkillable samurai and the rooks and the diamond-hunting eagles, those are myths that are current and in written accounts that exist in China. That these are Chinese myths about how rich and powerful Japan is, or about how they're getting these diamonds. So even his lies suggest that he's getting those lies from Chinese people. So right. One more proof that Marco actually did visit China.
So the evidence really points to the fact that he did visit China.
Yes. And the rest of his voyages to places like Indonesia, parts of India, and the Middle East. But I will say that I understand the skepticism, because even Marco Polo's contemporaries were very skeptical about his account. And this is actually reflected in the Venetian title of his book, that if you pick up a copy of Marco Polo in Italian today, it's still titled Il Milione, The Millions. And that no one in his lifetime actually believed the details of Marco's tales, especially the population figures that he set for China. The fact that there are cities in China with millions and millions of people in it is just totally unbelievable to people in European cities of 50, 60,000.
Yeah, that's ironic, because it's not the giant birds or the unkillable samurai with the stones in there under their skin that people doubted. It was the idea that there were Chinese cities with millions of people in them.
Yeah. And actually, on his deathbed, his family asked him to recant his stories. These can't be true. You're just making this up, right? And his last words that we have recorded are, "I have not told you half of what I saw." And as a historian, I read that and I say, please, please, I wish you had written down the other half. Where's the other book?
Well, maybe the other half is going to come out in the Netflix series. We should be so lucky, right?
Yeah.
Well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. Marco Polo, complicated as everyone else in history, and certainly complicated as all the other travelers and adventures we've talked about. Well, thanks a lot, Professor. We'd like to have you back on the show if that's possible.
Oh, I've got plenty of more historical myths to bust. So I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Well, we'll get institute researchers working on it, and we'll set up another connection.
All right.
Thanks again.
You're
Buzzkillers,
welcome.
Talk to you next week.